One proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported JAZZ 90.1.
And good afternoon. You are listening to this edition of Soundbites, and Nick is a little under the weather with the flu, so we're going to kind of do a little pitch around here and try to do the best we can without him. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Rick Harrison.
Filling in for the almighty Nick Francesco. So you know the routine. We appreciate your calls and questions. So if you would, pick up the phones, give us a call at 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Or you can text us. We do have that capability right here. And a number of folks do take advantage of it. And that's at 585-209-9010. And again, the local number here is 966-5299. Steve, you want to?
Yeah, let's start the week with a new
story. Start that while I start this other computer.
So one of the computers accidentally got turned off, and we were wondering if anyone around here knew anything about computers.
we got a call in.
Yeah, and I got to start the get the Ustream started, too. Let's take a look at the news. So Google is telling the feds that they now need to obtain a warrant to access Gmail. Search engine giant Google has told the U.S. government agencies that they must obtain a warrant should they wish to access Google Gmail accounts. American government agencies, which consist of federal, state, and local authorities, made over 8,400 requests for nearly 15,000 accounts from July to December in 2012. 8,000 requests in only half a year. 88% of those queries saw Google complying with at least a portion of the requests. Google added that 22% of the aforementioned requests were made were search warrants delivered through the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, ECPA. In order to compel us to produce the content in Gmail, we require an ECPA search warrant, said Google spokesperson Chris Gaither. If they come for registration information, that's one thing. But if they asked for content of email, that's another thing. During the December of 2012, the U.S. government approved a bill that sees law enforcement not being able to search through email, private Facebook messages, or other electronic forms of communications without a warrant. So that becomes our question in the poll this week. Google now requires a government to get warrants to access your Gmail account, and our choices are yay, Google, it's about time. Seriously, Google, huh? And doesn't the government already know? So how do you feel about Google refusing the government access to your accounts without a warrant? And I would almost like to say, wasn't Google doing this anyway?
Yeah.
The government asked and then Google said, okay, you didn't need a warrant?
Well, yeah, it's probably on the content. I think before, though, they just wanted the base, the information. Now they actually want to read the emails.
Right. If
that being the difference.
And that's what the Google spokesperson said. If they want registration information, does this person have an account and where do they live, that's okay. But if you want the content of email, you now need a warrant, which implies that beforehand you didn't need a warrant. The government didn't need a warrant to get into your mail. If we currently have 41 votes in our poll, and leading with 19 votes is yay, Google, and with 11 votes, it's about time, and doesn't the government know already, has 9 votes, and seriously, Google, bringing up the rear in two votes. And we all know that you don't want just to vote, you want to give your opinion. So in the yellow box at the bottom of the poll, you can click a link and take you to another website where you can give an opinion. And let's see, we have a few opinions already. A law student is saying Google should have been requiring this from the beginning. I've hated Google until today. Wink, wink, nodge, nodge. Barney refuses Big Brother. Want to buy a bridge? Uh-huh. So most of the people are saying that in the comments. They should have been requiring a warrant to begin with. For a private company to hand over your data to the government. It's very annoying. So what do we think?
Oh, I think they should have been doing it a long time ago.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think in your poll, what you should really do is lump your first two answers together because it's a much higher percentage. And they're so close in their wording.
In their wording, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, for the first two answers are about 75% of the respondents are saying, you know, it's about time, yay Google.
I don't know. You know, sometimes the government can get a little overzealous, you know, and there's stuff, and they just, you know, want to do a blanket statement because they're the government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we want in there because we suspect somebody's doing something bad.
Yeah, you know, more or less going to the adage, you're guilty until proven innocent.
Well, they have so much information that they've been collecting, and they were having difficulties processing it all, so they had to build all those new facilities.
Yeah, that's sort of always been the concern. You know, the stories about the NSA being able to tap all cell phone communications, all phone communications, all computer communications. There's just so much of that it's impossible to have the manpower to search through that and find something. So the rumors about Echelon and being able to pick out keywords.
Yeah.
So when the black helicopters come and drop at your house, you know you said something bad.
Oops.
Alrighty, let's go to the phone. Who was that? Who do we have on the phone?
We have Craig from Irondequoit. Go ahead, Craig.
Yes. Good afternoon. First of all, on that, the government, they're getting way too pushy. We need to put some restraints on them. So it's about time. Here's the problem. I'm really not that computer savvy. And all of a sudden, they came up with the FBI money pack virus on my home computer. And my wife's about ready to kill me. Are you familiar with that virus? And is there anything I can do relatively cheap to get rid of this?
Well, there were some Trojan horses that were basically emails claiming to be from the FBI saying, you're doing something wrong. We're going to come and arrest you. One of our first opinions of that was the police don't usually warn you that they're coming to arrest you.
Yeah, that's kind of absurd.
Yep.
Exactly.
But these blanket emails go out. Websites have been attacked by them. Generally speaking, if you dance the security tango, that does a pretty good job of removing these types of things. But we're often seeing some of these are now having some of the viruses are now having a rootkit aspect to it, and they are very hard to remove from your currently booting system.
Right.
So quite frequently, you need to take your hard drive out of the computer to put it as a secondary drive on a clean computer and scan it from there.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, that's something we do at our shop, and that's the only way you can do it because you got to get your rootkit out. I think that may be the phone.
That's the phone. Ooh, that is mine. Sorry, I thought it was on vibrate.
Anyways, you'd go ahead and, you know, we'd have to pull that out first to get the initial rootkit out. And then from there, we can then dive into, by putting it back into your machine, getting the rest of the remains and that type of stuff out of there. But it's the key thing is that it doesn't boot. And that's why, you know, putting it out on a separate computer is the only way around it. I mean, there are some the older ones, the older rootkits that using super anti-spyware or malware bytes, you can get a lot of that stuff out.
Okay, so you're suggesting then that I get that out and just get to another computer then?
Yeah, try to hook it up to the other computer as a slave and then do the cleaning on that. And like I say, malware bytes, hijack this is another one that you can use to clean a lot of that out. Yeah, if you check the Soundbites webpage.
Yep, okay. We have a link to the Security Tango at securitytango.com with steps on virus removal for Windows, Mac, and Linux.
Excellent, because I got it on the computer, and there were so many different supposedly helps for this virus, and I don't know which one could be bogus and which one could be actually helping.
That's part of the problem, yeah.
SecurityTango.com.
Yeah, if you got any questions, call the guys over at Laurelton. They know all about the stuff we recommend. I do all their computers over there.
Okay, I bet.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Take it easy.
All right.
Had to put a little shameless plug in.
Yep. For our the Laurelton Fire Department near Nick's house. Dave's house did a wonderful job when Dave had his heart attack a few years ago.
Oh.
It's nice to have the fire and ambulance right across the street when you need them.
Yeah, all I had to do was wave.
Oh, well, that was huge. I mean, I walked, because by the time I would have taken myself to the, to the hospital. No. Yeah. And waiting for the, fire, it was easier to just quick hop in the car and I could have rolled down the street and made it. Walked in there, and they go, Dave, you don't look too good. I got these chest pains. Boom, they had me sitting down. Boom, you know, couldn't say higher praises about the guys over there and the whole team at Northside's, and then especially at Strong. I mean, talk about in and out. Holy mackerel. I never saw somebody move so darn fast. You know, you just walk in. Where's the heart attack patient? Right here. Meet me right on down. You know, you go down through the basement, and I'm all wrapped up because it's November. And I remember going through all this maze in the hospital once they took me downstairs, and it was like this long, dark hallway. And there's this young lady standing in front of this OR. Is that Mr. Enright? They go, yeah, this way. And all I remember is being quick slapped on the gurney. I think it was like, I want to say maybe 3-4 hours later. Woke up in recovery. And my wife was there at the time. And she goes, hi. I go, I think I had a heart attack. You go, yeah, you did.
Wow. Well, thank God for the EMTs.
Oh, they were phenomenal. Like I say, just bounced me. Because they had to take me literally from the fire station over to the north side, or not north side, Highland. And then from Highland, they go, you're not staying here long. And I wasn't. I was there maybe 20 minutes, back on another ambulance, and over to Strong.
See that, and that's the big thing. If you're lucky enough to have that fire department, you know, emergency rescue across the street, yeah. But generally speaking, it's better to call for an ambulance because they have equipment in the ambulance, life-saving equipment and whatnot, that can be treating you en route to the hospital.
Yeah, like I say, by the time we would have made the call and by the time they would have responded and got there, we were already down there.
Yeah.
Because I am literally 2 minutes, if that, away from the fire department.
Yep.
So.
All righty. Let's go to Don from Rochester. What can we do for you today, Don?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Unfortunately, Nick's not here. I'm curious about the, you know, Nick's got his Chromebook and all that.
Yeah.
I understand, you know, everything's not 100% safe, but how do we feel about putting, you know, kind of like sensitive information within the Google Docs and the Google Drive and stuff like that?
I trust it.
I don't use it.
Well, and especially after our lead news story, now that Google is requiring a warrant to get into your information, it's a little bit safer.
Mm-hmm.
Your data is encrypted during transport, so between you and Google, the data is encrypted. But once Google has your data, they can theoretically look at it. But since we were mentioning earlier, also so many people are using Google, there's just so much data there to sift through. There's no reason for them to want to do that to you. But now,
yeah, but that was just emails that they're going after. Now, if you're using the Google Drive to do backups, so say of documents and all that other stuff, they're not going after that.
Well, not yet, but probably only a matter of time. Yeah.
Well,
I was kind of looking because you know to use that to put, you know, all the various different passwords, all kinds of, you know, the sensitive information. And then you can access it from your tablet, from, you know, from wherever. It's in one central place. You can get it off your phone. You could do whatever
yep.
with it. But my concern was, you know, just the security of it.
Yeah. There was an episode of the Security Now podcast on the This Week in Tech Network a little while ago. We have a link in our link list from a couple of weeks ago. We talked about it. And they did a roundup of all of the different cloud storage solutions from a security and encryption standpoint, whether the data is encrypted at your end or if they have the encryption keys at the other end first. And quite a few of the systems worked out very well. Carbonite was one of the more popular backup and cloud storage solutions that's encrypted by you. Some of the other services, Dropbox is a very popular service, but the encryption keys are kept by Dropbox, so theoretically they can get into your data. They say they won't unless they have a warrant, but that's been sort of the issue too. And one of the things you can do is use your own encrypted image with a free program like TrueCrypt and put that encrypted image on one of the cloud drives. And then it's encrypted by you before it gets to the other end, and so they have no chance of seeing your data at the other end.
I've got Folder Lock, which I think is kind of the same thing. You know, you just put everything into an encrypted folder. But now, in order to read anything, you'd have to download the whole thing. You can't just open it, I don't believe.
Yeah, you have to decrypt the folder to see the contents of the folder, yeah.
Yeah, so.
And that's some of the, and that's one of the limitations of some of the cloud services. They may not have a mobile app to do the decryption on a file-by-file basis. So something like Google Drive and Dropbox, which is so convenient to use, there is that encryption and privacy that you have to trust Google that they won't do anything with your data.
Now, what about CrashPlan, Steve?
CrashPlan is also a nice backup solution, and they have a really interesting plan that you can back up to a buddy's house so that, say, your buddy has a hard drive, you have a hard drive, he backs up your stuff, you back up his stuff, and that is all free. And that gives you an offsite backup because it's at your buddy's house.
And it's also encrypted, too.
It's also encrypted,
so your buddy
right.
can't get into your
data. Buddy can't, right. And then CrashPlan also has cloud storage where you store your data on their server. And they have a neat issue that one of the problems with all the cloud storage solutions is that it takes a very long time to upload all of your stuff to back it up because your upload internet speeds are relatively slow. So CrashPlan has an option where you back up to a local hard drive, you mail that hard drive to them, and they put it into their cloud so that it works a lot faster.
Okay, well, as far as the internet speed, eventually maybe someday we'll have Google here, but it's another story. So,
yep.
All right, gentlemen, I thank you for your help here.
Yep, no problem.
Day.
Great, thank you for calling.
Okay, that music tells us that we got to take a short break and actually listen to some great words of wisdom from some of our underwriters here. So we will be back with a few more questions and hopefully a lot more answers, but we also want to remind you, please pick up the phones, give us a call at 966-5299, toll free 1-800-790-0415, right here at Member Supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on Member Supported Jazz 90.1.
And you are listening to this edition of Soundbites minus Nick. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Rick Harrison.
And we have Wesley on the phone. Go ahead, Wesley.
Hello.
Go ahead, sir. Hello?
Hello.
Go ahead, ask your question.
Hello.
Yeah, ask your question, sir.
Yes, how can I tell if Homeland Security's been interfering with my Hotmail?
You can't.
Yeah, because I've got I'm sending things out to newspapers because I have a story about it, and, you know, Democrat and Chronicle, I'm sending things to there, and I get delayed and then blocked. As far as my story getting to them.
Well, that sounds like just a mail issue. Probably nothing to do with Homeland Security.
Well,
it's usually fairly rare.
If it wasn't for the fact that my wife is not being allowed to come into this country because she was one day late on a visa, I believe it was just a mail issue. But it seems to be only, and I had sent it to two different addresses to this paper. And I get the same thing. And then I had sent my sister a email regarding the email address of my immigration attorney because she was going to send in a statement, and that got sent back to me, too.
What's the bounce error?
First it said delayed, and then blocked.
It should say why it's blocked. Yeah. In the rest of the message.
It didn't give any reason it was blocked at all.
You may have to open the long headers to see the rest of the error message.
Hmm.
Usually that means that there's a typo in the email address and they can't find
it. There's no typo because I've used these email addresses before.
Yeah, but have they changed?
And they're in my contacts.
They may have changed at the other end.
And could the server at the other end be down?
Didn't, though.
Your sister didn't get her email?
No.
That you sent her?
Yes.
That sounds like something else besides that, because there's no way they would turn around and block you, you know, sending another member. Now, going to, you know, some other agency or something like that, that you could have had something mistyped or anything else like that.
You might have accidentally got on a block list.
Yeah, that's possible.
You could try a different email service and see if that happens from there, too.
Set up a Gmail.
All my other email services have been slowed down to a crawl since this stuff has been going on. I'd be called paranoid if it was just, you know, one thing, and I was, because I didn't want to think that such a thing could happen, but...
Try a Gmail account and just try sending a Gmail to your sister off of that account and see what happens.
Well, I've actually just gave her the information over the phone after that, but, you know, it's beyond suspicious at this point.
Yeah, if things are slow with your router, you might want to try resetting your router.
Well, I've already did that.
Okay.
I called up my ISP and everything, and they went through it, and they said, oh, this is rather odd.
Yep.
But they didn't go any further into
You could try from a different computer, too.
Huh?
You could try from a different computer at a friend's house or a public library?
The last couple of emails that got bounced back, I did from my friend's computer. That's what's really made me suspicious, that it's not my computer, it's the account that's being manipulated.
Yeah, but when you're going to that, it doesn't matter what computer I'm, because you're logging into their service on the Hotmail. Yeah, so it doesn't matter. You could be at the library.
But what I'm saying is, I know it's not something that's in my computer.
That's what we're saying. It's not something there. It's, you know, within the Hotmail. Like Steve was saying, you could have gotten on a blacklist.
Yeah, so try a different email address.
I haven't done anything to have earned that. I know.
Well, it happens. It happens accidentally all the time.
Anti-American activities.
Well, it happens accidentally all the time. Every couple of months, yeah. Roadrunner gets put on the blacklist
or on purpose, and we can call it an accident.
Yeah. Every couple of months, the rr.com domain will get put on a blacklist because somebody sent out too much spam, and then so everyone using Roadrunner gets blacklisted.
I don't distribute spam, though.
Right. It may not be you. There's millions of other people using Hotmail.
Yeah.
And one of those people might have done something bad that got Hotmail blocked. And usually it corrects itself in a few days. Sometimes it takes longer than that to get...
The thing is, I had contacted, you know, this person, the reporter, by phone.
Well, this isn't going to solve anything, sir. I think what you got to do...
He said, send it in. And I told him what email to look for it on and everything, so he could put me under the contacts, so it should have gone through.
All right, sir, what you might want to try to do is set up a Gmail account. That's another free service, and try doing it that and see what happens with that. Okay?
I will.
All righty. Have a good day.
Thank you for calling.
Bye.
Yeah, it's weird. Usually those blocked messages will give you more details, but you have to be sort of a mail computer an email computer expert to understand what all the messages mean. Sometimes the message is easy, the mailbox is full, and so your message can't be delivered, but sometimes there's weird problems along the way. Usually when you get a delayed message, it means there's a router too busy somewhere and the mail can't pass through, especially if you're trying to go to a very popular site. We see that with Yahoo every now and then. There are so many people using free services like Yahoo and Hotmail that it sometimes gets slowed down because there's too many people doing it at that given time.
And, you know, depending on, you know, like you said, the time of day that he's doing all this, I mean... There's so many variables without actually seeing what's going on, you know. It.
Your ISP, or well, your mail provider, which is Hotmail, so who do you find at Hotmail? You could try Googling the entire blocked message and see if that would help you, but you might be able to go into Hotmail Help and see what that blocked message might mean as well.
Yep. All right, tell you what, let's go back to the phones. We've got Wayne from Henrietta. Go ahead, Wayne.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to put in a positive plug for Windows 8 Pro because I have it running on three machines, and it's very robust, it's fast, and I've yet to find an application on Windows 7 that won't run on it. And I just want to let everybody know, because it's available for $40 as a download from Microsoft until Thursday, and I actually played with the pre-release version of it over the summer, and I thought I was absolutely going to hate it, but I bought a copy of it because I needed another way to run another copy of ArcView. I have to run multiple copies of ArcView, and it doesn't run real well on XP. And to my surprise, I've really liked it. I'm running it on a desktop with a Logitech rechargeable touchpad, so it gives me some of the swipe features mm-hmm. that you wouldn't normally have on a desktop.
And you've gotten used to the Metro interface?
I have. Much to my surprise,
he's
for
the
a
one
while,
user.
I was using the... I just saw a write-up of it, in fact, in the latest issue of PC World. I've been using something called Classic Shell, which actually gives you the Windows 7 start menu back.
Mm-hmm.
So you can kind of, you know, use it without the Metro interface if you want. But I've actually gotten used to it. I mean, I don't like all the things that just flash up on your screen and give you information all the time. I kind of disabled some of that and made my own groupings of things. And it is definitely a different paradigm, but it's I can't believe how fast it is. It's actually it's very solid. It hasn't crashed any months. I've been running a couple months.
Well, it's all built on the Windows 7 platform.
Oh, definitely. In fact,
yeah, it's all there, but all they did was
6.3, and I think 7 was 6.2 or something like that.
Yeah, and I mean, they're doing is, like I've said before, and I think we've got a story coming up in a little bit about Windows 8. I still say the biggest contention, you know, it's going to be for a lot of folks, is that Metro interface.
Oh, I agree.
Too many folks are used to too many times, you know, for years, back from Windows 3.1, having that start bar and a start button that you could go and click and do this and do that. This was a whole paradigm shift and an operating system look and feel that this is what's really... you know, going to be the downfall, I think, of Windows, and not including when you boot up to have either the Metro look or the old classic look.
I have a good feeling they're going to put that back in Service Pack 1, but there are several third-party utilities.
You take your average user, though, they don't have a clue. You know, you seem to be a little more experienced in knowledge. I mean, to, you know, get into, you know, going in, downloading this, installing this so that it can, you know, get back your old look.
Yeah.
It's got to be made a lot simpler for folks to install and use.
If Microsoft adds that feature, that the danger is no one will ever get used to the new interface.
Exactly.
So I could see it. I could have seen it because Apple's done this with their interface changes. There's always a system or two where you can do it both ways. And so Windows 8, they should have had the switch in, and then Windows 9, it's Metro only. So you have that transition period to get used to the new way.
But yeah, still no, though, for a desktop. I mean, the Metro, the whole thing about the Metro is the tablet look for the tablet and the phone.
Mm-hmm.
To sit there and have the screen, you know, tablet.
Until we get touchscreen desktop.
Yeah, until you get that. And how many folks are going to want to lean over the keyboard to sit there and do swiping?
That's right.
Exactly, and that's why I added a Logitech rechargeable touchpad that works really well and allows me to do the swipe stuff. I'm getting used to it, and actually, I had something called Classic Shell, which gave me the start menu back, but I actually took that off because I'm getting used to the Metro interface, and I never thought I would. But
yeah, Apple has the Magic Trackpad, so you can do those swiping features on the desktop. But with the with a lot of tablets in the market,
proliferation.
Decided to give up on that one.
Yeah, I find myself when I happen to use my laptop, I'll reach up and try to swipe because I'm using my tablet so much that I'm used to that.
Yeah,
and so we're seeing it on laptops too.
Right, I have a laptop, an older laptop that with Windows 8 running. It's running great on that too, by the way. I'm just waiting for somebody to reach up and swipe across my screen and cringe. So. Yep.
Well, for years, we've had to deal with fingerprints on screens.
Right.
When you never need to touch the screen anyway, how do those fingerprints get up there? And now with tablets, we're
because if you got somebody over and you got to show them, you know, you got to point.
But now with tablets, I'm constantly having to wipe fingerprints off my iPad because you're supposed to swipe your finger on it.
Right.
I just saw a new technology demonstration that the thing isn't generally accepted yet, but they're in testing of an interface where you can wave your fingers in the air in front of your computer.
We've started seeing that. It's the Microsoft Kinect. Actually, LeapPad, the kids' game, have a little small one, and we're seeing people test things like that. So it uses the camera that's built into all these computers now, and it can see when you're swiping. In fact, Apple uses that for the ambient light sensor. When it's dark out, it will dim your screen and light up your keyboard on models that have that. And there used to be a separate little sensor in the computer that did that. Now it uses the camera. So if you cover your camera, you can notice your screen will darken and your keyboard will light up because it thinks it got dark out.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of interesting.
Oh, well, just one thing. Other thing I wanted to mention is that I also picked up a book called Windows 8 Secrets, which is a good overview, basically what's different in Windows 8 between Windows 8 and Windows 7. And it's maybe the only computer book I've ever read cover to cover.
That's
very helpful, and I think it's helping me get a lot more out of it than I would have noticed otherwise. I think the biggest difficulty of Windows 8 is noticing what's there that's different that you need to find.
Yeah, so that's a Paul Theriot book, and he is a very well-known Windows writer. He does the Win Supersite. Mm-hmm. And he actually does a podcast on the This Week in Tech Network called Windows Weekly, where they talk about all the Windows stuff. So yeah, he's a very very well regarded author.
Can I ask one unrelated question?
Sure.
What's the latest on the Java exploit? I noticed that actually this past week that Firefox actually jumped up and disabled my plugin for Java. So I assume that there's still an issue. I thought a patch went out.
But. Yeah, Sun. Oracle now did release a patch. What is it? Update 14, I think, is out. But what we're seeing a lot of the browsers do, something Apple something Apple started a little bit ago. Java is disabled by default until you need to run it, and then it will ask for you to turn it on, and it runs what you need to do. And then it disables itself when you don't need it anymore.
Wow.
So it gives you an added level of security. So if you know, the problem is novice users. If you know you're going to a website that needs Java, then you know to turn it on. And if you don't know you're using Java and a little Java thing pops up, you cannot turn it on because you don't expect to be using it.
So has Java always been that vulnerable, or has it just become increased vulnerability in the last few years?
It's not that it's that. It's always been that vulnerable. It just hasn't been a target until lately.
Yeah.
Shifting focus. Flash and Java are installed on so many machines because Windows and the Mac, the operating systems themselves, and so many people have antivirus programs running already, that the threat model is changing.
Right.
And so now the bad guys are attacking more things. And what we're seeing is that as soon as a patch comes out, then there's another exploit that gets released almost immediately.
Yeah, they just shift their focus.
And the bad guys have lists of patches all waiting, and they release an exploit that uses one hole, and as soon as it gets fixed by the manufacturer, they release another one. Yeah,
right.
So they have a whole bunch of things waiting to get released. But the latest Java exploit was patched with Java 7 Update 11. And that will make sure that you're safe from that latest exploit.
Right, I do have several applications that use Java, so I can't really turn it off.
If you want to hold on, we got to take a break.
All right.
And we'll come back to you in just a couple of moments. But right now, we've got to listen to some of our great underwriters here at Member Supported Jazz 90.1. You are listening to Soundbites right here on Member Supported Jazz 90.1. Love this tune. Welcome back, folks. You are listening to Soundbites. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Rick Harrison.
And our fellow teammate here, Nick Francesco, is a little under the weather, so we wish him well. And hopefully, I know the bug is going around bad and not very nice right now, but we still do have, Wayne, I believe, on the line. Go ahead, sir. You still had another question?
No, just to make one more comment about Windows
8. No, go right ahead, sir.
You're talking about security. That's one of the things I like about it, some of the enhancements to security, such as Secure Boot, which you need updated hardware for, and Windows Smart Screen, and they've put in Window Defender, but this time antivirus as default. So there's some default security that I think for new users that it's running in the background immediately when you install it. So mm-hmm. I think that's a good thing.
But. No, that's great. Like I say, I still think, you know, Windows 8 has a little ways to go, mm-hmm. you know, in that. But, you know, like I say, they kept it on a good platform, which was Windows 7. I mean, Windows 7 has been rock solid since the day one that it came out.
Mm-hmm.
There was never any complaints, no major patches and updates, you know, like Windows XP had to do, you know, Service Pack 1, 2, and 3. I mean, they learned from that, and Windows 7 came out, and boom, it just ran.
Right. And I find the same with 8, but it's a brand new interface.
Right,
so,
and that's my only contention against it. And I think, you know, I'm hearing from a lot of folks in the industry that that's the only thing that's going to stop a lot of folks going to Windows 8 in most companies because they can't afford to retrain folks.
Right.
I mean, if folks are comfortable with the look and feel and you've got all this money invested, and especially right now with times being so tight, to turn around and say, all right, yeah, you got to dump all these computers and go to Windows 8. Not happening,
well,
you know.
My main message is, you know, for $40, give it a try. That's what I thought.
Oh yeah,
or,
no, for home use, yes.
Download it now for $40
until Thursday. Yeah,
and until the 31st, right?
To...
You don't need to install it now, but get it while it's cheap, and then when you're ready, you'll have it.
Well, exactly.
See, that's another indication, in my estimation, that there's issues, even though you know. They're not coming out and saying, you know, they're saying sales and that are all great. No, I think that was because of the holiday.
Right.
And one of the stories we got coming up, I think a lot of it is like anything else. It's pre-installed on, you know, a lot of devices. So, yeah, your sales are going to look good if folks are buying new computers because that's the way it comes. What they didn't say is and quite often you can get is what they call a downgrade. And when you get the Windows 8, you can also get a downgrade going back to Windows 7.
There's a picture running around the internet, and I want to know if it's real or not. A computer store advertising a special downgrade to Windows 7 for only $125. I kind of believe it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. But I think, like I say, it doesn't hurt, you know, if you want, like you say, to download that, put it on another drive. And, you know, a lot of machines nowadays, you can do a dual boot.
Oh, yeah.
So you could go
booting all of them, Windows 7, Windows 8,
yeah, you could go back and forth. Yeah, back and forth which one you want to boot off of.
Mm-hmm.
And give Windows 8 a look and feel because it will, like Windows 7, you know, use all the memory that you give it and the speed, you know, it's unbelievable. It is definitely a, you know, great operating system. They even tweaked it a little more than Windows 7.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's just that interface. It too many folks in business and that aren't going to accept it.
Right. Well, you guys have a great day.
You too, and thank you for calling.
Thanks
Take
for
care,
calling.
Bye.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I hate to go on and on and on, but I think that's where their bloated numbers are showing up. It's just the Christmas sales, and to turn around and offer it for $40. I mean. The company's got to be hurting somewheres instead of, you know, offering it for like 80 or 100.
Yeah, they're not getting the acceptance that they used to get.
Mm-mm,
well,
no.
let's talk about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, go ahead.
That
yeah,
new story we've been teasing.
Segue into it.
Yeah. Microsoft boasts record revenue following a Windows 8 sales push. Over 60 million Windows 8 licenses have been sold to date, according to Microsoft. This week, they announced their record quarterly revenue, $21 billion in revenue. And the Windows division posted $5.8 billion in revenue, up 24% from the prior year. And that number slides to 11% when factoring in the net deferral of the Windows upgrade offer, which was people who bought Windows 7 could get a free Windows upgrade if buying it soon enough. All tallied, Microsoft figures it sold 60 million Windows 8 licenses to date, although it's unclear that how many of those licenses came from Surface sales rather than Windows 8 desktop licenses. And one thing to remember is that Microsoft sells to OEMs, not only to end users. So companies like Dell and HP might have bought tens of millions of copies
right.
that they're going to be selling this quarter. So Microsoft says our big, bold imagination to reimagine Windows as well as launch the Surface and Windows Phone 8 has sparked a growing enthusiasm with our customers, an unprecedented opportunity and creativity with our partners and developers, says Steve Ballmer. With new Windows devices, including Surface Pro, which had a release price of $899, and the new Office on the horizon, we'll continue to drive excitement of the Windows ecosystem and deliver our software through devices and services people and businesses love.
He's drinking the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of marketing there.
Well, Xbox, on the other hand, posted revenues of $3.77 billion, down 11%. Nevertheless, Xbox continues to be the top-selling console, I think partly because we're seeing people are running games on their smartphones and their tablets rather than a dedicated game console. Despite the strong revenue numbers and Windows 8 sales, there's a bit of a turmoil behind the scenes. Internally, Microsoft is said to be blaming PC makers for not being ready with the attractive Windows 8-based touchscreen tablets. In response, Microsoft's hardware partners say that they've built up a stock of Windows 8 tablets they'll probably be stuck with and nobody will want. And partly because Microsoft is selling their own Surface tablet, rather than OEM partners selling their tablets. Yeah, so it's you know, would you buy an HP tablet or would you run a Microsoft tablet if they're both running the same OS?
And again, going against, and even though I'm on the Windows side, I mean, Microsoft's track record, I'm sorry, is not very good. You know, they'll get into something, and if it doesn't prove a profit really quickly, they abandon it.
Well, and sometimes they've been known to keep pushing bad products for years until they get it right.
Yeah, trying to get folks to convince them, brainwash them enough to think that, you know, oh, yes, you really need this. And then they, oh, okay, well, I'll go ahead and do it. And then they pull the plug.
Yep.
Yeah.
But again, that last statement, I think it's all the pre-holiday stuff, like you said, Steve, you know, the Gateways and the Dells and the HPs and everything else that are preloading it.
Yep.
And it's hitting the stores and they hit some real good deals out there. Folks were getting it, and, oh, there's, you know, it came with Windows 8. I've heard a lot of folks say, it came with Windows 8. Can I put my Windows 7 back on this? Yeah.
And then they do.
Yeah.
Have you done that yet? Is it how tricky is it?
It's not hard.
Well, it's probably you just erase it and install Windows again. But what if you already have data on it?
You just ghost it over. Well, you can ghost it over.
Yeah.
You know, you can ghost the image. You know, if you take a new box and say you, you've got your stuff on an old Windows 7 machine, you want to go to this Windows 8, ghost it over. You know, say it's an older Pentium 4 machine, quad-core, and you want to put it on this newer, faster machine, you can ghost the image over to it, and then you'll have to do a reinstall over that just to, you know, verify the license, because you're taking the license off of this one and moving it over to this one because you're scrapping that one.
Yeah. How about drivers? Have there been issues yet with drivers?
No. Again, because it's based upon the Windows 7. Yeah,
that was the big problem with Vista. There were no drivers for anything.
Oh, yeah, and nobody wanted to support it. And again, the story was stating, you know, oh, yeah, well, you know, folks don't want to do it on the tablets. Because Microsoft, who was it that said they weren't going to really support? I forget what tablet maker said that they were really going to get into the Windows Windows 8 tablet mode because they didn't see a market for it. One of them, they said, sorry, you know, we're just not going to go there because, or was it one of the stores, Google or one of those, as far as doing apps for Windows 8? I think it was apps.
They were offering $100 for you to develop an app.
Well, and Google said they're not doing Windows 8 apps. There's been no demand for them. No one has Windows 8 tablets in quantity enough yet to bother making Windows 8 apps.
And there was, I believe, a number of weeks ago, Nick was talking about how one tablet maker said, no, we're not going to bother going there because, you know, Google and Ice Cream and the Android system is rock solid, and more folks want that. And now going with the Chrome tablet that Nick has, that was pretty slick. You know, seeing that and what it can do.
A full Chrome computer for $250 that does web browsing and Google Docs and email, which is 90% of what people want.
And I think what it had, I think it had, 32 gig of memory for storage?
That might have been the 16 gig model.
Okay, 16, one or the other.
But most of your storage is done at Google, so you don't need local storage.
Yeah,
that's right.
And that's where, you know, I know some of the listeners out there aren't familiar with what we're talking about. But along with Google, besides doing, you know, the great searches and, you know, emails and everything else, they have what they call Google Drive, if you haven't heard about it before. And they're giving you, I think it's 5 gig of storage space for free. And what gives you the capability of not only storing it, but from any of your other devices. Now, like I've got, you know, I set it mainly up on my computer at home, but then on my tablet or on my phone, any of the documents that I need to get at are up there on the cloud. So if I'm on it, you know, like I say, I have my tablet with me and I want to look something up,
yep,
no problem. I can go over to my Google Drive and there it is. I don't have to be logged in back at home. And I've had to do this a couple of times. I had to pull up a document, went into my Google Drive, there it was, and I was able to print it off to a local printer where I was. No hassle. They thought, oh, that was cool. How'd you do that? And I was explaining it to them. It's very simple to set up. And the only thing I wish Google Drive would do is set it up that you could have a, like a sync, you know, I mean, automatically set up automatically to back things up.
Well, it does a sync, so whatever you put in your Google Drive folder on your computer gets synced and backed up to the cloud.
What I had to do, though, was I wrote a batch file to take the things that I have on my computer once in a while and move those over to my Google Drive. The batch file runs at night. It just copies things over to the Google Drive folder, and then from there it does the sync.
Yeah, because you only get 5 gigabytes, that's not enough to store all of your stuff.
Well, there's other, you know, the business information, you know, that doesn't even take up.
Yeah, typically, like your Word files are really small, but when you want to back up your photos and videos,
no,
they
I don't
get
bother
big.
About that. But just the business, you know, financial stuff and that type of stuff, you know, you can put up there just as another form of backup because I've got redundant backups as it is now. Excuse me, but just being to have the capabilities to have it in another place that's secure and I can get at if I ever had to, you know?
Yep.
Something, you know, catastrophic happens or that type of stuff. But it's just handy. And again, if you get into the habit of using the Google apps or the, like the document writer or, you know, they've got a lot of applications right there that you can create documents and everything else. When you save them there using the Google products, it doesn't take up any of the 5 gig storage.
Yep.
So you're getting a lot of free storage if you use their applications to write Word documents or anything else, which can be shared by everybody.
And you can buy more storage if you need to. They have 25 gigs for $250 a month. All the way up to 16 terabytes for $800 a month. if you need a lot of space online.
I don't think I'm going to be doing the 16 terabytes anytime soon.
Next week, maybe?
Yeah. I wouldn't mind having 16 terabytes at home.
store on it?
Yeah, I was going to say, what would you do with even 8 terabytes?
I download a lot of movies.
I doubt you'd fill it up, Steve.
No. But my 1 terabyte drive is constantly full, so I definitely need something bigger. See, my problem is I have a 1 terabyte in my Mac and a 1 terabyte backup drive, and they're both full. So
full of stuff.
I need 2 drives. I need a bigger internal and a bigger external.
Well, the 3 terabytes actually aren't such a bad deal these days.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. But you know what? With him and his family, they'd fill that up too.
Yeah, it's always full.
Yeah, but then you'd spend all your time deleting stuff.
I never delete anything.
Yeah, see, there's an issue, too.
I might need it someday.
Yeah, but if you've already watched, say, a movie or something like that, it's okay to delete it. You can get it back
down.
You can
get it back if you want it again.
There's this thing called the internet, and you can do searches. And quite often, Steve, you can find it and put it back down there.
Yep.
It does free up space. It won't hurt. Promise. You know, you can slowly do it. You know, we got to do this in baby steps for you.
It's always a time issue is what it comes down to. There's always something that has a higher priority. And, you know, to delete your stuff, oh, that takes time. So I know where he's coming from.
It must be a Mac thing. It has to be with you two
Not
guys.
Not necessarily. Well, it's a podcast. You know, 90% of my space is the podcast I listen to. and watch. I usually get the video podcast because if I have the time, I can watch the video, but it's usually the audio.
It takes up a little more space then,
yep.
too.
Yeah, well, that too. But, you know, I mean, moderation, Steve. Moderation. Yep. Okay, tell you what, folks, that does tell us that you have, as Nick would say, wasted completely 1 hour of your life listening to us and some of our listeners calling in with their computer questions. But we do recommend that you pick up the phones and give us a call right after this break at 585-966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Or, since we are a computer show, you can text us at 585-2090. All right, for right now, we're going to turn this back over to a lot of our great underwriters, and we will be back just momentarily with more sound bites here at Member Supported Jazz 90.1.
Line now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And good afternoon. You are listening to this edition of Soundbites here at member-supported Jazz 90.1. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Rick Harrison.
And you want to go ahead and start up with one of the stories?
Yeah, I guess, yeah, at, what is it, 4 minutes after the hour. Let's read another news story here. You can't hide from Facebook graph search. It often seems as though Facebook's main purpose is to remind us continually of how much we have chosen to share with the world about our online behavior, whether we realize it or not. The latest lesson along those lines comes from the social network's new graph search, which sounds at first like a fairly boring feature, limited to only marketers. Like much of what Facebook does, however, it's also a warning sign. If you were counting on certain things about yourself staying not so much as private or obscure, those days are definitely over. For example, for an example of what this means, look no further than the new Tumblr log from a London-based programmer, Tom Scott, entitled Actual Facebook Graph Searches, and we'll have that link up shortly. This sounds like something somewhat dry and academic until you take a closer look at it. Some of the things Facebook makes it trivially easy to search for are things like Islamic men interested in men who live in Tehran, where homosexuality is a crime punishable by death. Family members of people who live in China. The latter is a Falun Gong, which is a religious group whose members are routinely persecuted. So these searches Maybe figments of Tom Scott's overactive imagination for now, but the fact is Facebook's graph search makes them relatively easy to conduct. Dave Morin, a former Facebook executive who left to start the mobile social network Path, has pointed out that the company has had this kind of interest graph-powered searching for some time and kinds of targeted based on likes and interests of friends and followed pages, but has been available only in a different form for advertisers. This is by far more robust and more public now. In a blog, in a fact on the blog, Scott says that he's not trying to make any deep arguments about privacy, and his Tumblr blog is subtitled, "Don't worry, we'll use this in a few weeks' time," but it's still worth thinking about the implications of Facebook's graph search, especially given the fact that many people don't seem to appreciate the nuances of the network's privacy settings, something that Facebook doesn't really make that simple or easy to figure out. Even Chief Executive Officer Mark Zuckerberg's sister, Randi, was recently blindsided by the Facebook privacy issues when a picture of hers was accidentally made public. So what chance do the rest of us have? So how do you feel about more of your data being exposed on Facebook? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 585-966-5299. Or you can call toll-free at 1-800-790-0415. And let me put this link up, and we'll see what, you know. So the advertisers have been going to Facebook and saying, we want to advertise, you know, car parts. Mm-hmm. So give us men between the ages of 18 and 49. That live in urban areas.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a typical advertising search. But all of your data is on there. All of your likes is on there.
Yep.
So you can really get detailed. You know, find me, you know, African-American men who are 17 years old, who live in urban cities, and who like Reebok sneakers. So really detailed stuff, because all of your stuff is on Facebook.
Well, that's why you've got to be, you know, again, it's user beware and kind of think about what you post up there and what you say that you like and don't like, you know, because like you said, once it's out there, forget it.
That's right. Make sure you check your privacy settings for Facebook. That's very, very important.
Yeah, because you can block a lot of people. You know what I mean? Everybody thinks, you know, you can open it up to all your friends. But even on that, you can block certain people if you don't want them getting in.
And the trick is friends of friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's friends of their friends and friends of their friends and friends of their friends. And suddenly it's a billion people.
The one thing that I don't like is actually LinkedIn. Because LinkedIn, you put your little profile out there. And the next thing you know, all your friends have shared their email address books with LinkedIn.
LinkedIn was supposed to be a way for people to find jobs, basically business people looking for experience.
Networking.
And you can put your own work skills on it and people could find you easier. But it's just turned into another link bait and spam farm.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, tell you what, let's go back to the phones. We've got Bear from Pittsburgh in there. Go ahead, Bear.
Hi, guys. I think this question's probably for Steve.
Okay, Steve, it's all yours.
I just got a new and I got to remember pad from pod because I have so many of them.
I have that trouble too.
Yeah, I got a new iPod Touch. I have iPads and am familiar with them. And on this Touch, I cannot get my email account to work. And what happens is, and it's got to be something really simple, but when I enter all the information, and I did it just the same way for the iPads that I have, and they all work, when I enter it, it says that the username and the password is incorrect.
Okay.
Which I am absolutely sure is not true. And I've been messing around with this for a week now, and I'm just about ready to drive over to one of the Apple stores and say, can you help me with this? But my last chance is, do you have any clues what might be happening?
One thing we have seen is the type of password encryption you're using. And I just had a customer that was that ran into that earlier today. Most email systems use a password authentication called Password. Some of them use MS Chat. Some of them use SSL. Who is your email provider?
It's Rochester Roadrunner.
So they just use ordinary Password. So if you go into your settings app and into your email and into your email settings. Make sure that password is set to, you have to go under advanced once you're in your email settings, and make sure authentication is set to just password. So the error message that you're getting from the mail server is technically correct because it's the wrong type of password authentication. So the it's not authenticating, and so it's sending back and said, no, that's not working. So if you have it set to the wrong encryption, are the wrong settings, or you have it set to the none. In fact, for my customer this morning, actually their authentication was set to no authentication, and that's not an option. So I don't know how they got it set to that. then that will prevent the mail server from working.
Okay, so let me ask you again to repeat that. It needs to be set to what?
To password.
Okay.
And for Roadrunner, SSL has to be off. And authentication has to be set to password.
Oh, you know, there's where my problems are going to be. So when I go into settings, can I find an email settings?
Yes. In settings, you go down to Mail Contacts Calendars, and that lists all of your accounts, and one of your accounts will be your Roadrunner Mail account.
Hmm. I hear you, but I don't see it.
You might have to swipe up to scroll down a little bit in your settings.
I am. And it's between, so I'm in settings,
yep,
but I'm looking for what?
Mail contacts and calendars. It's between iCloud and Notes in the fourth group of settings.
Yeah, well, you're really good. I see iCloud and Notes. Well,
I have one open in front of me.
Oh. It's mine. I gave it to him.
I have Rick's iPod and I have my iPad.
Yeah, you know what? Maybe we're finding a problem here because when I go down below iCloud, I have my iTunes and music and videos and camera and then Twitter and Facebook and that's it.
Right above that, there's an iCloud, mail contacts and calendars, notes, reminders, messages.
Oh.
What OS are you running on your iPod?
I don't know. I just got it this week.
So then it's probably OS 6. So that should be there.
It's updated.
Yeah.
To the latest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the first group of section is dealing with Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. And then
and I see it now. Yep. Mail, contacts, and calendars.
Right.
Yes.
And then you go in to edit your Roadrunner account.
Okay.
And then you make sure that under advanced settings, SSL has to be off.
Okay.
And authentication has to be password.
Perfect. Let me give that a try, and thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
All right.
You're welcome.
Yeah, some of those settings are tricky. And then the other issue we run into is that mail servers are designed to allow mail from their own customers. So if you're connected to a Roadrunner network, you can send your Roadrunner mail. If you go to a friend's house and they happen to have Frontier, you can't send your Roadrunner mail because you're not connected to Roadrunner anymore. So what Roadrunner has done and what Frontier has done too is in your sending server, the SMTP server, you have to use the mobile Roadrunner server and then authenticate with your username and password. And that lets you send mail when you're not connected to your home network. So that can be a little tricky for people, too. You can receive your mail, but you can't send your mail. That means that your SMTP settings have to be changed.
Isn't email such a wonder?
Yep. Some people have just given up and just gone to webmail because it's often easier than trying to configure your mail client. But webmail interfaces are usually difficult to navigate, and there's ads
and
everywhere.
Change and all the time, mm-hmm. too. The whole problem with the computer industry is that as a whole, things are constantly changing, and
never
to
stays
keep up
same.
With it yep. is impossible for your average human being here.
All right, tell you what, let's go back to the phones. We got Mark in Greece. Go ahead, Mark.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Who walked in?
I wanted to make a comment. A couple months ago, you guys had a caller, and you were talking about the Samsung Galaxy Player.
Mm-hmm. Nick was.
I took the advice and I got one for Christmas, and I only paid like $99 for it. It's the 3.6, and I absolutely love that MP3 player. It I love that it's Android based. I tell people it's a smartphone it's all the smart without the phone, basically. And it's a great player, and I just wanted to tell you, I took your guys' advice, and for $99, it was a steal.
Well, we got one thing right this week.
Absolute steal. I don't like Samsung software,
mm-hmm.
that key software, but
yeah.
they give you the option of using Windows Media Player.
Okay.
And that's a great option because that works great.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make your playlists, and right. you can use it as a mass storage device also. So it's got three great ways, you know, if you like the key software, you can use that. But three great ways to just sync that player, and I think that's great.
Well, that's great.
Because
when I had
my Zune, I was locked into that Zune software, which mm-hmm. was really buggy, and,
Mm-hmm.
If I had another option, why Microsoft wouldn't let you use Windows Media Player, I have no idea why they made us use that Zune software. But anyway, Samsung, I think, is ahead of the curve.
Well, as they are in a lot of their stuff. I mean,
yeah,
you know.
It's no surprise that they're really taking off the way they are.
Yep. Oh, yeah, no, we see that in a lot of things. You know, not only that, but, you know, their TVs and phones and everything else. I mean, They do a good job. They do their homework, and they get it right.
Yeah.
And it's something that somebody really wants. And like I say, Nick has been gloating about his Galaxy and loving it.
Yeah, it's It's really cool. So I just wanted to tell you guys, I took the advice and tried it, knowing that I could take it back if I didn't like it. And I love it. So.
Well, that's great.
Thanks for the info.
Well, no, we appreciate the feedback because, like I say, we can, tout things until the cows come home. But, until we get some other listeners, like you calling back and saying, hey, I tried this and it really works. Or, that's a piece of junk.
Right. Exactly.
That's what helps make, other listeners maybe want to take a look at it. And just like Nick and I constantly talking about the Nexus 7. It was due to him getting one and me seeing it here in the studio and what it could do and everything else. And I like the smallness of it and everything that it could do versus on a tablet in a nice small size that encouraged me to go out and get it. And now both of us have been touting it for quite a while. And I've had a number of other folks do the same thing, just like you have. I went out and bought one and they're loving it.
Yeah. Like, and I said, $99, I couldn't beat it with a stick.
Well, that's great to hear. Thank you for the feedback, though, sir.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you for the info.
All right, have a good one.
Keep up the great work.
We'll try. I was just thinking about that again. I was talking, telling a friend how, we are the longest-running show because they had never heard us, and started to think, which I once in a while do, because there is a party going on in my head, and I don't always get invited there, but... this Labor Day starts 25 years for us.
Wow.
Nice.
That's longer than my first marriage. And this is hanging out with three other guys. We haven't wanted a divorce or hung each other yet.
Well, because we only have to get together once a week for only 2 hours.
Good point.
Oh, but no, it's, like I say, it makes me, wonder about, 24 years already gone by. All right, with that, we got to take a short break here and listen to some of our great underwriters, but we will be back, and we encourage you to pick up the phones, give us a call, 966-5299, toll free, 1-800-790-0415, and you can get your questions answered right here on the one and only member-supported Jazz 90.1. And welcome back. You are listening to this edition of Soundbites. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Rick Harrison.
And hopefully our friendly Nick Francesco is sitting home, recouping, and getting the rest that he needs so he can be here next Saturday here on Soundbites. But meanwhile, we've got another caller, and we've got Harry from Rochester. Go ahead, Harry.
I've got a question on screen background color. On XP, it's pretty easy to to change. You do a right-click on desktop, and you get appearances, and you could select the color you want. But on Windows 7, you're stuck with themes, and I really can't change background colors like email or any of the other programs. Do you have any suggestions on how to do that?
Well, on the desktop, besides a theme, you can go down, scroll further, and there are just basic colors, and you can do your own custom color.
And that's for the whole screen, not just the border, huh?
Right, that's for the whole screen. Yeah, the theme's up there, but you got to scroll down a little bit past that.
Okay.
And you can just get the plain, I like really dark blue for mine.
Yeah, I like light gray. To contrast the, the black...
Well, there's a number of folks. As a matter of fact, I've got a few friends that are visually impaired, and going to the darker screen, backgrounds, makes the, text and everything else or the current window that they're working on pop out more. So it's an advantage for them. So, yeah, they just went in, and you go down to the... scroll down a little bit more, and you can select other colors.
Okay, will that work with the email? I have Outlook on it.
Outlook, I don't know if you can change the colors on that. Uh-huh. This is just your basic display. Quite often, it's dependent upon each application on whether they'll give you the option to change, colors within that.
Yeah, that was a nice thing about XP and appearances. You could, do it once on desktop, and then everything looks Like I like that light gray.
Mm-hmm. Well, give it a shot.
It looks like it is possible. I just found a link at Microsoft to change your Outlook background colors, gradients, textures, pattern, picture, font, graphics, everything.
Oh, where do I go for that?
We'll put a link up there. Yeah, if you go to our Soundbites page at soundbites.org, Francis would want us to remind you. We have frequently asked questions.
A links list.
And there's a links list there.
And the list of links mentioned on the show.
And each week you can always go back and see, you know, forgot something like, oh, they mentioned that 2 weeks ago. You can always go back to our list, and we go back at least all the 5 years that we've been here.
So background colors is mentioned in that list?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Well, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
There's usually something in there. Let me see if it tells me what version of Outlook that works with.
That's why I wish in, like, Google Calendar, though. They gave me a little more options of changing some of the background colors and that, you know, even the text. Yeah. I got to figure out when I have some free time.
There's a couple of options. You've got compact, easy to read, but not that many options.
Yeah, like my work schedule and that, I can go in there and, you know, when I highlight a block, I put that in orange. And, you know, this way I can...
Yeah, the calendar, you can make different colors.
Yeah, for a block, but I'd like to do the typing, you know, the actual lettering, a dark, you know, excuse me, I'd like to have that in a black, not this other light color.
I don't like that light gray so much.
Yeah, no,
That may be one of the labs. Event Flare is a lab. Bring life to your calendar and organize your events and icons. So you can add icons and fonts.
Yeah, I've done that. But,
so that's called Event Flare. Oh, so if you go into Labs, you can add new features that aren't there by standard.
All right, so you
go to a little gear thing, mm-hmm. and then which is where you get to your settings, and then you can go to Labs and add new features.
Well, if they let me change the font, that would be great, because with my eyes and the bifocals, sometimes my phone isn't long enough.
Yeah.
In reach with my arms that I can say,
Yeah, there's one called Compact, where everything is smaller and you get more on the screen. There's one called Comfortable, which is bigger, but you don't see as much.
That's called for the older people.
Yeah. But then, you can go into Labs and make changes to the events and add new features as well.
Well, that's, you know, like I say, that's the whole thing. If I don't have my glass.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You have to use the human zoom with the arm.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I've had to do once in a while because technically all I need them for is the reading. I'm great, you know, when I'm on the bike or anything else, I can, you know, ride without glasses on. Luckily, the distance hasn't gone yet.
Yep.
Yeah, when they both go, you're in real trouble.
Yeah, but luckily, you know, I mean, like I say, knock on wood, I haven't had that issue, but me being the oldest of the three, you never know. What else we got there as far as news there, Steve?
Yeah, let's take a look at this. So security maker Lookout is giving Android users a way to catch smartphone thieves red-handed. A new feature of Lookout Security and Antivirus for Android called Lock Cam automatically snaps a photo from a person's front-facing camera after three unsuccessful unlock attempts. So when someone steals your phone and they try to break in with your lock code, three incorrect guesses, and it takes a picture. It will then upload that picture as an email along with a photo of the culprit. Users can log into their Lookout.com account and see the location of the phone as well as the location history. To use Lock Cam, you need a phone running Android 2.3 or higher with a front-facing camera. And, of course, you need to set a PIN on your phone. Most people don't lock their phone with a PIN. You should do that so anyone picking up your phone can't go into your contacts and do whatever they want. You do that by going through the Android Settings app and under Security. You should then receive an alert from Lockout in less than a minute after someone botches your unlock pattern a few times. It would be nice, though, if you could set the number of unlock attempts allowed before Lookout sends the alert, and you might want to send a message after just one or two attempts. Lock Cam is clearly a lure for Lookout's premium service, which costs $30 per year or $3 a month, which adds extra features such as remote wipe and remote lock. A new premium feature added in the last update lets customers add custom messages to their phone's lock screen, such as a phone number to call or a request to return the phone to its rightful owner. Keep in mind, though, that you don't need to pay for Lockout's annual subscription fee to get remote wipe on Android phones. A third-party program called SeekDroid and another one called Cerebus offer remote wipe, remote lock, and other remote security features for a one-time fee. Another app that's in beta now is called Android Lost, which provides many of these services for free as well. So if you keep a lot of important or sensitive data on your phone, your contacts, your email addresses, your banking account information, anything you might put in your notes, it's worth spending a few extra minutes locking it down, putting a pin lock on your phone so you can't just touch it and get into it. And in some cases, even turn off the 4-digit pin and turn on a full alphanumeric pin.
Cool.
So that people can get it. So do you lock your phone? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 585-966-5299. Or toll free at 1-800-790-0415.
I'm afraid I don't lock mine.
Yeah, there's always that trade-off between security and convenience.
Mm-hmm.
It's more secure to have a lock code, and that way other people can't get into it. But it's not convenient, because I want to get into it.
Yes, that's true. What I figured out is that if somebody gets my phone, it means I'm dead.
Well, I did.
Well, because they're not going to get it unless it's over
my
dead
body. Because we do a lot of on-site work. And so I've left my phone at places. I've left my iPad at places.
I lost my one phone back in last summer. It was back in, I want to say, the August-September time frame. You know, I lost all my numbers and everything else. But I did have the lockout that I was able to wipe it. So granted, I lost everything and a lot of numbers that, you know, I had to, through emails and that other type of stuff.
But at least no one else got it.
Yeah, no, nobody else got it.
Yeah,
but yeah, you know, there's that much on there. You know, I mean, a lot of my contacts, you know, family but a lot of friends. You know, I had to contact them again and say, hey, you know, I lost my phone. Of course, a number of folks did turn around and say, well, you know where I live. Yeah, it's just me getting my butt over there. And saying, hey, forgot. You know, it's so easy. And this is where we get complacent. You know. Just doing that. But tell you what, let's go back to the phones. We got Ken in Maryland calling us. Go ahead, Ken.
Right. I got a question. We recently had a problem at work where we had an older PC and a USB stick, and it was infected with the conflictor worm. You remember that from a couple years ago?
Yeah, it's actually making a resurgence.
I was wondering, is that possible to get back into the servers at work if they have them all patched properly?
Well, there's a new variant of the conflictor worm that's coming out that uses a different attack method. I was just reading about it earlier this week. So it is possible the new variants aren't being detected by the existing antivirus stuff.
Yeah.
And depending on how old your computers are and what OSs they're running, they may not be getting the latest updates as well.
Right, but it also went back to the server at work, and it was infecting other PCs. I was just wondering, maybe they're not doing all the patches at work.
That could be, yeah.
You know, just make them aware of it, and, you know, like, since it's out, you know, and the patches are already probably there, it's just a matter of them getting around and applying them.
Right, because what they want to do, they want to ban the use of USB sticks, and that's a nice tool. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
Well, yeah, because if you happen to put your USB stick into an infected computer, it can infect the USB stick and then get into other computers that way.
And that's one thing that I have a problem with in USB sticks. When they first came out, a couple of them had locks on them. So you could turn around and, you know, lock them.
Password protect them, too, yeah.
Yeah, and so nothing could get written onto them. What I use for us and in the shop is a USB drive, but it's got an SD card in it because the SD cards have a little lock on the side of them. So I can go ahead, load all my software up, and if I put it in a customer's machine because it's locked, nothing can get onto it because it's locked down.
Yeah, that's a smart idea.
Yep.
What about CD-ROMs, if you burn CD-ROMs? You think that makes it pretty safe, or you could still get the virus on that?
If the computer you're burning it from is infected.
Yeah, that's... And there lies the challenge. Where in Maryland are you?
What's that?
Where in Maryland are you?
Oh, it's at Laurel, Maryland. just outside of D.C., I guess.
Oh, okay, so you're picking us all the way down there.
Oh, only on the internet.
Well, hey, pass the word around and let your friends know.
Well, you got a pretty good show. You're one of the few that are left.
Well, thank you very much. Like I was saying before, we've been doing it 24 years. We're coming up on 25 this coming Labor Day. I know it sounds a long ways away, but and I don't want to rush the riding season, but yeah, we'll be starting 25 years this coming Labor Day.
Right. Okay, thanks for the
Well, thank you for calling, sir.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. The long distance calls that we sometimes get here. It's nice to have those. I'm trying to change my account. I've been playing with this multi-camera setup, and so I have to remember to change my cameras when other people are talking. It's sometimes doesn't work right, but it's interesting.
Yeah, you can turn this one that you got on me over to the wall. I definitely have a face.
Well, you're talking more this week, so I'm pointing at you.
All right, tell you what, let's go back to the phones, and we got Joe from Chickawaga on the phone. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I must say, I love taking my Nexus 7 shopping.
Yes.
Because it has the NFC chip, and you can sign up for Google Wallet and pay by credit card by simply tapping your Nexus 7 against a compatible credit card terminal.
Mm-hmm.
I also take along because I have been using OI Shopping List. OI standing for Open Intent. They're an Android developer, and they have all sorts of open source projects that you can get on the Google Play Store. But it is a really wonderful little program because it maintains the database according to, the top level is you can have several lists, but you can put all the single items on a list, and you can say, oh, what stores can you get that at? And you can keep track of prices so you can competitively shop around and say, oh, yeah, you know, Price Right has a better price than Aldi, better than Tops or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was the name of that software again?
OI Shopping List.
Cool. We'll take a look at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it works really well for me because I want to kind of combine all my shopping into one. So, you know, I don't go out for groceries and then, you know, go to the hardware store, go to
kind of plan your day.
I need to go.
Yeah, kind of plan your day and go out and around and hit all the stops that you need to do and get the good prices.
Right, but the way the program is structured is, so I have my one huge list of the things I get all the time, bread, milk, eggs, whatever. And then I can check them off as I get them.
Mm-hmm.
I can also take like my tablet into the pantry in my basement and say, okay, I need this, I need this, I'm out of this. That's what they call picking.
Yep.
Kind of like when you're in the warehousing industry, you pick something off the shelf. And, you know, that's why they call it pick, I guess. But you know, then you have all the items you need to go get,
mm-hmm.
and you just check them off one at a time. It's like, okay, I got eggs at Price Right. I don't need to get them again at Aldi.
Right. Yep.
That sort of thing.
Oh, okay, cool.
I've got a cookbook program for the iPad called Epicurious, and it's got recipes in it, but then it also can tie in as a pantry inventory database. So you can say, what can I make with the stuff I have in the closet? Or you can build a shopping list. You know, I want to make this, add this ingredients to my shopping list, and it can even sort based on your grocery store if it knows the big chains of stores.
And the one thing I do is when I go out, I add a pin to unlock my tablet, but once I get home, I take the pin away and all I need to do is slide to unlock.
Well, cool. Well, thanks, Joe. We got to take a quick break here. As always, thank you for calling. And you are listening to member-supported Jazz 90.1 and Soundbites right here. And we will be back in just a moment.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1, turn your radio down. 2, turn your radio down lower. 3, remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4, make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5, calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
And welcome back, all our listeners. You are listening to Soundbites right here at Member Support at Jazz 90.1. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Rick Harrison.
And I want to remind you folks, if you still got about a good 10 minutes, and we got a couple open lines, that if you want to give us a call with your computer questions, the numbers are 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. And go ahead.
For another, all right.
Yeah.
So for another one. Paid apps are now history on the iTunes Store. It's not as good as you might think. Last week marked an important moment in the evolution of the iOS app market, as Pages, Apple's word processing and page layout app, slipped out of the iPad top 10 highest grossing apps chart. There are now no paid apps among the 10 applications that generate the most revenue on the iPad. And I was bringing up my top of the charts just to see where we are now. When the iPad application market was born a few years ago, it was dominated by a relatively stiffly priced applications mimicking the PC software or game console software markets. But over the past couple of years, app vendors have realized that free apps with clever, some say annoying, in-app purchasing hooks create a much more revenue than paid apps. The same applies to the iPhone. There is only one paid app among the highest 20 grossing iPhone apps, and it is notable that some of the highest grossing apps have relatively low download volumes. Clash of Clans has been a top grossing iPad application for all of January, but it is only ranked 53rd on the iPad download chart. Heyday is the seventh biggest application when it comes to revenue, but is ranked at 104 when it comes to download volume. So you don't have to have a high downloading app in order to make a lot of money on it. Leading app developers have figured out how to decouple download volume from revenue generation by creating free games that seduce their fans into paying steadily for in-app features. Give them a taste for free, and then they'll be addicted for life. Mm. Where have we heard that marketing before?
Yeah.
These types of games require a 99-cent or a $2.99 fee for a download, are turning something that resemble nostalgia items. For a stark example of how badly the revenue generation power of paid apps has faded, consider that the current number one paid app on the iPhone, Wood Camera, is 46th on the iPhone chart of top grossing apps. The future belongs to free apps. So do you have more paid apps or more free apps? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. 1-800 toll free at 790-0415. And Rick, as a paid app developer, what are your thoughts?
Well, actually, the free apps, as Steve was saying, are really not free in a lot of ways because of these in-app purchases.
Yeah, we've sort of called them freemium.
Yeah.
They're free to buy, but you have to pay real money to advance in them.
And, okay. And I really think that that's, you know, not as honest as they should be. I mean, when I download a free app, I don't want to be bothered in the app, you know, you need to, you know, buy this little goodie to make your software work the way you really want it to.
Yeah, you want to clear this level, you have to buy this thing, or you have to buy. You don't want to wait for your farm to generate, you know, profits. You can buy more gold with real money.
Yeah,
and we've seen over the years, parents have run into problems with that, where the kid somehow gets the password and runs up a big credit card bill buying things with real money in the app stores.
You know, and the App Store apps are so inexpensive. Like my app, Idea Phrase Creator, is 99 cents right now. Now, one of the strategies I'm going to go to this next month is I'm going to release a free version of that, and then the other one will become the pro version.
And that's how a lot of apps do it. They, mm-hmm. they have one free and one
paid. To get the taste, and then once you get the full version, then other options are turned on.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And I think that's a much more honest model to go with.
And a lot of the software packages do that, and there's nothing wrong with that, you know, because you're not no deception there. You know, you're getting it for free to try out. Now, if you want more features, then you pay, and that I don't think you'll find very many folks disagreeing with that.
Well, I just noticed right now on my iPad, the number 8 top grossing app is Minecraft for iPad, which is $6.99. Which is kind of expensive for an iPad app. And my son just loves Minecraft. We paid for the desktop version. And it's a retro game. It's 8-bit gaming with giant blocks. Although no, I think they upgraded to 16-bit now.
Yeah.
But it's a world building program. So it's a lot like the Second Life that we do our shows in on Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern. Stop by Second Life. And but Minecraft is hugely popular. Still pretty well grossing.
I guess I'm not familiar with that one.
It's a lot of people liking it to Legos. It's big blocks that build things with.
Okay.
And actually, now that Lego has their copyright has expired, anyone can make blocks that look like Legos now. I saw a guy, a Lego master. That apparently, is a big Lego expo coming up in Germany. He built a Sikorsky Sky Crane out of 100,000 Legos.
Oh my goodness!
It's about 6 to 8 feet long. It's about 4 feet tall. A giant helicopter.
How many hours did it take him?
Yeah, about a month, he said.
Uh-huh. Ow.
So some of these world builders make giant things out of physical bricks.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're seeing in Minecraft, people are rebuilding the real world in Minecraft, just like they've been doing in Second Life.
Yeah. And out of virtual bricks.
Out of virtual bricks, yeah.
Yeah.
But you got to watch out for the zombies that come out at night.
Well, you know, $6-7 bucks for a program, that's inexpensive, folks, you know, especially when you can think about years ago,
software
was, you know, $70-80, $100.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's how much enjoyment do you get out of it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, then if you really like playing it a lot, then that should not be an issue. You know, you're paying that developer for his time and effort.
That's right.
You know, and it only inspires him. And in any app, whether it's Minecraft or anything else, whether it's your app, Rick, or that, to do more. Because you can put one out there, and if it's free, you don't give these developers any incentive to add other features or to do other things with it if you just throw it out there. Because I can remember back in the day when I was programming, I did a bunch of shareware. And I got a couple people to subscribe to it. But then it was like everybody's complaining, well, where's that free program? And should be updating this and updating that. And it's like, well, buy it. You
That's
know,
right.
You know, pay me for it. You know, you enjoy using the software. You know, no, thanks. Well, then, thank you much.
That has been a traditional complaint in the shareware world, is that very few people actually pay for their shareware. We've actually seen some statistics that more Mac users pay for their shareware than Windows users did. And we know a few game developers in town that that run their whole business, big employees and fancy offices on shareware payments.
Like Ambrosia Software.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it took me a while to do that particular program that I developed. And it was a lot of fun. But again, you know, if they're not going to, you know, give you the support, one incentive is there to even continue. And that's I wound up doing. And I did a couple updates, but then after that, it's like, nah, there's just not the interest. But yet, like I say, I get an email every so often because I always had my name down at the bottom of the program that if they wanted to email me with questions or that type of thing, when's the next update coming out? I'd say, well, and I'd look and, you know, send me, you know, I wasn't, and I think at the time I was asking like $5.
Yeah.
You know, for the updates, and it's like,
if you don't get your money back from your development costs, you're not going to develop any more apps.
Yeah, and, you know, I spent quite a few days and, you know, over a month and a half developing it and fine-tuning it. It was all menu-driven, and the user could basically not have to know a lot about it and what they wanted to accomplish with it and do it. Mm-hmm. It just happen. So, you know, yeah, I can see where developers would get discouraged. As I did so many years of programming, got burned out.
Yeah, there was that story a couple of weeks ago that there was a couple that went through and they invested everything that they had into producing their app and like $200,000 or something, and they hardly made anything back. I think it was like $5,000 is what they made total from their app.
Yeah, I know. It's just very disheartening.
Yeah, a lot of times it's the big games. Yeah, we've seen how big Angry Birds is. They're very, you know, there's very, very few of those giant bestsellers that mm-hmm. make their developers a ton of money. It's mostly the smaller developers that you know they have a small income, and hopefully it's enough to quit their day job. You know, that's what we're always hoping for. I want to quit my day job. But a lot of times it's they're programmers during the day that work for their company, and then at night they work for themselves.
Well, that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's back in the days when I was working at Kodak and working on my bachelor's degree in computer science on the side, and so I didn't have enough homework and all that, developed this, and it was kind of interesting.
Alrighty, yeah. So do we have any more news?
No, or you know what?
We're almost out of time.
Yeah, we're just about out of time. I hate to mention, get into that, but...
Let's just say really quickly that Mozilla is working on a Firefox browser for mobile to go along with Chrome that's out, and then Safari on the iPad, and hopefully that more choices is better.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I hate to say it, guys, but... This kind of wraps up this edition of Soundbites. And Rick, I want to thank you again for coming in and filling in there for Mr. Francesco.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, our pleasure. And always, we'd like to have you on. And Steve, maybe we should do this again next week.
Maybe, yeah.
It might not be a bad idea. All right, tell you what. We're going to call it a night, or a day, I should say, for this edition of Soundbites.
Yes, it's a day.
Oh, thank you very much. All right. George is coming up next with the greatest German music that you're ever going to want to hear. And again, for me, Dave Enright, Steve Ray, and Rick, we want to thank you for all you folks that did take the time to call in, and do it again next week, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.